I don't know what exactly was going on. You know, I don't have a right, nor do I have access to the contract. That's really something that happens at the benefits committee level. But certainly for patients, we are either responsible for the list price of a medication. So if we look at the list price that basically nobody pays, our health plan could be getting a price reduction called a rebate or a discount or a fee, whatever you want to call it. And our coinsurance will still be based, or, you know, particularly in a coinsurance situation, not so much on a copay, although I have a story for you on that. Our coinsurance is based on the list price, not the reduced price of the medication. So it becomes really problematic because at times health plans can make significant money off of their sickest patients. So there's a really great gap graph by Antonio Sicada out of 46 Brooklyn, and he actually has an example where the plan makes $1,000 off of the patient because they're paying the full price, so they're paying 20% of the full price. But in this case, the drug is discounted so heavily, it's $69, but the original price is $403. And so at the end of the year, the plan has actually made money. And a lot of plan sponsors don't actually consider that a problem. I would urge them to think about and consult a lawyer about whether or not that's a prohibited transaction. So prohibited transactions mean that the plan and the people who are affiliated with the plan can't actually make money off of the participants.
And for a self-funded plan, for example, who would be retaining that money? Is it the pharmacy benefit manager, or is it the employer who is taking on the risk of its employees?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It depends on how the contract is structured. In Antonio's example, it is the employer and the plan that is retaining that money.
Is a big part of the complication and the interactivity between PBMs and people is the relationship between PBMs and self-funded plans? Or does this happen with health insurance as well?
Yeah, so that's a health insurance problem that, and I mean, actually employers would be in a much better situation to address that and say, we're going to make your copay 20% of whatever we're paying. That doesn't seem to have taken hold quite yet as an answer, but really, and I mean, from the employer perspective, I know I'm being a little bit hard on them. From the employer perspective, they see it as equalizing the field for people who have high cost conditions, and then the rest of the pool, right? Because they are paying more. I'm aware of that. I still wonder if it's very ethical to do that. But what's great about Antonio's example is, so in Antonio's example, where there's no sort of clawing back of the patient assistance or whatever, assuming that somebody does that, is somebody's paying $400 every month. And so assuming a $1,200 or a $1,600 deductible, they meet their deductible in 4 months. Let's say it's a $1,600 deductible. I think that's the minimum for a high deductible health plan. They meet it in 4 months. And then the plan starts to have to pay. And so while the plan is paying less initially, but you can think of this as sort of your Menards rebate situation where maybe the price is already inflated and you have to wait until you mail in the rebate, and you have to meet a bunch of other conditions in order to get this discount to $69. You know, the person then meets their maximum out of pocket in a few more months, and then everything becomes free, which is a stupid saying, but yes, it's everything is quote free, even though somebody's always paying. And so it really disincentivizes any type of really thoughtful approach. If you think, and then he has a great example of a rebate-less model where the person is paying $69 every month, which I think we can agree is a lot better than $400 in the initial phases, and then 20% of $400 as we go on. The person never meets their deductible in this situation. And so the plan actually never starts to pay for that medication. And so that's I think, the twist that we need to start thinking about as a country and as insurance, that if we actually shared this and reduced the cost to what people might be paying, insurers would actually be paying less than they are now. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be profiting, but you know, if you think somebody is a complex patient, it's not just the drug cost that's expensive, and yeah, that might be a lot, but they're going to the doctor, they're maybe getting MRIs, they're getting lab tests, et cetera, et cetera. If we reduce the cost of the medication and they're not meeting their deductible, I mean, I don't think people tend to go super crazy with the healthcare. That's just a personal opinion, but they're still going to do other things. And they may be less concerned about going to the hospital for their lab tests that maybe could be several times more than an outpatient lab location. And so all of these start to add up to develop very poor shoppers that are not very invested in saving the plan money because the plan is not invested in saving them money.
Can you say that last part again and just explain it a little bit more?
Yeah, so there are these perverse incentives that turn the plan against the patient, the beneficiary, right? So if you have a situation where a plan is demanding that a patient overpay for their drugs, they have, I think it's fair to say, demonstrated a disinterest in helping that person save money. But also, so if they're required to pay 20% of a list price of a drug that the plan is not seeing at all, the plan is not helping that person save money. And they're going to meet their maximum out of pocket, they're going to meet all of these things that really makes people poor shoppers. Because then you just say, I mean, many people will just say, well, it's free. And I mean, I've heard it from my doctor. Oh, well, don't worry about it. You've hit your maximum out of pocket. It's free. And you have this disincentive to save the plan money because you're like, well, I paid so much. Why? Like, why do I care? And the plan is hurting because they maybe have recouped some cost on the drug side, but then they have this person who maybe is not a very savvy shopper because the plan isn't incentivizing them or helping them to save money by saying, hey, let's give you this nudge. Like, I use a direct primary care, and going to get labs from her is, I think, like a tenth of the cost as going to my local academic hospital. And so I actually called this morning. I wasn't feeling well. I want to do a panel of labs. Said, hey, can I come in? Whereas like some people would just call their specialist at the hospital and say, hey, you know, I need an appointment, blah, blah, blah. Like, can I come in? Then the labs are ordered. It's like $800 for the labs. And so that's where this push and pull between plans, like a plan responsibility and maybe looking to make money off of the drug side and so charging people more, but then creating really bad consumers because the plan isn't actually helping them become good consumers and save money.
So to the best of my ability, I was trying to understand a little bit more about how this works. And there was a Brookings article that said, where patients face excessive cost sharing, the main cause is likely deeper market or regulatory failures, such as consumer difficulties in choosing insurance plans and adverse selection. Addressing those issues is likely to require solutions targeted at those broader problems, such as directly regulating how much cost sharing insurance plans can impose, subsidizing more generous coverage, or improving risk adjustments, not solutions specific to rebates or PBMs.
Well, I haven't read that article. My initial gut reaction is I get very concerned when we start to demand more, particularly in the employer market, because employers have what's called a minimum value standard. And so the minimum value standard is they have to cover at least 60% of the cost for an average population. So CMS has a whole table. Now, getting to that minimum value with a high deductible health plan is very, very difficult. So to their point, regulating how much is happening. What we're starting to see is some employers are becoming very savvy, and they're recognizing that investing in primary care, specialty care, and so removing any type of cost sharing there, it starts to become very attractive, because as people develop relationships with their primary, they will more likely do what I did earlier today, which is reach out to the primary, go to the lowest cost location of care, get services, and then triage with them whether or not it makes sense to go see a specialist. And if so, which specialist in my pantheon of specialists is it appropriate for me to see at that particular time? As employers invest more in the medical side, fundamentally the medical side makes up 70% of all cost maximum. I mean, if you've got a really big plan, medications likely look more in the 15 to 20% of total plan costs. For smaller plans, that's going to be higher. So as employers invest in the pool of 70% and maybe direct to a place in outpatient orthopedic center for a knee replacement or a joint replacement that's significantly cheaper, so they cover it at 100%, that minimum value standard becomes very easy to achieve with just outpatient, you know, care, or, you know, even some inpatient, but on the, you can achieve it through the medical side alone. So I become concerned when we start talking about the requirement to cover, or, you know, cover at a higher rate, because I do believe fundamentally we already all pay enough, that there is enough coverage to go around. But how we allocate that, for example, a woman approached me in September and I got this phone call and it said, "Hey, Anne, what do you think of this situation? I am paying $20 for a medication. My plan is paying $1,500, and I learned that I could order it off of Mark Cuban's for $9. So in this case, I'm not sure it's a market failure. I'm not sure that requiring her plan to cover more of that cost, which, I mean, she's on a copay plan, so it's already reasonably restrained, but if she was not and she was paying 20% of this $1,500, like, to me, we need to help employers understand. We need to help them become more savvy shoppers. And I think we need to start pressing the matter of how patients interact with the system and what the duties to these patients are from employers. I tend to lean towards less regulatory involvement because you do start to see a cascade of things that maybe are not fully anticipated when you start regulating things. And so I would very much like to see, you know, the topic of discount. I mean, first of all, I would have absolutely no problem with removing discounts, rebates, and fees as incentives because I do believe that they distort the market. And I would love to see what the market in the U.S. looks like without them. And once we have that conversation, once we kind of pull back the curtain into the OPAC and sort of black box that is essentially pharmaceutical pricing, I would love to see what patients are paying and then determine whether or not further action is necessary.
And so kind of relating to everything that we've talked about and this black box, I mean, it's very, very complicated.
Yep.
And is that intentional?
How do you mean intentional?
I can't be a informed customer if I don't understand what's happening.
Yes. So I would say there are very large companies with billions of dollars at stake. I mean, that's not an underestimate. That's very conservative. So I do believe, I always believe that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so I do tend to believe that right now the system is built for, you know, to keep it sort of a black box at this point, because it does serve companies that are making money off of it. I'll never forget. Okay, so my job at this large manufacturer, a lot of it was to talk about the problem of discounts, rebates, and fees and how they impacted patients and all of this. And so I one time came back from the Alliance, this employer group, and, you know, I had some guys and they're like, okay, so you've been showing up. Okay, well, we'll start to talk to you a little bit. And one guy's like, so when are we just going to get lower prices? Like, I'm sick of this rebate thing. I would never do this in any other supply chain. Like, you know, I know when I go to Menards and they have their 11% sale, it's 11% over what I could go find basically anywhere else and I could get the same product. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go do a presentation on how bad discounts, rebates, and fees are, saying we lose 53 cents on every dollar, et cetera, et cetera. So in my brilliant idea, I went to a senior director in my group and I said, so why don't we just publish the price? Seems like a no-brainer. Well, Anne, then everybody would know the lowest price that we would allow, and we don't allow that right now, so why would we do that? Well, if we're losing this much money already, like, why wouldn't you just say the 50-cent price or maybe the 35-cent price or whatever? Because the silly part about that is that the Medicaid prices, the 340B prices, like the really steep discounts that are available here where a Medicaid plan may be paying a penny or at this point possibly even less, are already publicly available. And so we know what those prices are. What we don't know, the prices that are paid are really in relation to these private plans where I really do believe employers want to do the right thing for their employees and offer this coverage and be good. But I don't know how, as an employer, I would be able to say I've done an appropriate fiduciary process and been able to, you know, confirm that I know that I'm getting a good quality, a good price, and all of that in an area that's just a total black box.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take a break?
Yeah, we'll let my husband in.